residential value problems, so I'll talk about that. Once I've addressed those issues, I'll show you how we embedded inflation into these kinds of non-local constructions. I'll give our predictions for the CMB. And then in the last part, I'll focus on the most interesting prediction, which is for large non-Gaussian entity. So I'm going to focus on a fairly general class of non-local field theories that can be cast in this form, where all the non-local structure in the theory is encoded in this, what I'll call kinetic function F box. And you get theories like this with non-trivial, non-linear kinetic function fairly generically in string field theory. You get it in a variety of toy models of string theory, like the p-adic string, or also when you quantize strings on a random lattice. You can get something similar as a low-energy effect description of unparticle dynamics, and also in certain Brangwell constructions. And moreover, you get similar kinds of non-local field theories, though somewhat more general class than this, whenever you study QFT with a minimal length scale, and also something similar in non-commutative geometry. So the explicit example that I'll keep coming back to throughout the talk is this p-adic string theory. So this is a toy model of the bosonic string theory. The reason this is a toy model is because you take the world sheet coordinates of the string to be valued on the field of p-adic numbers instead of on the field of real numbers. So you should think about this as a very special kind of a discretization of the string world sheet. And it turns out that when you make this special kind of discretization, you can compute all the amplitudes for the tachyonic state in this theory, and then you can write down a fairly simple field theory Lagrangian that reproduces those amplitudes. So the action that you get looks like this, and here MS is a string mass, GS is a string coupling. P is this prime number that characterizes the world sheet coordinates. And this is derived for P prime, but you can analytically continue the action to other values of P as well. And here, phi is this scalar field which encodes the tachyonic instability of the D-brain in this theory. And the thing to notice here is that the kinetic term has this e to the box kind of operator, which you can understand as an infinite series expansion in powers of box. And so there's a non-local field theory containing infinitely many derivatives. So when you vary that action, the field equation that you get also contains infinitely many derivatives, and it looks like this. There's an infinite order partial differential equation, and in the ODE case, you can actually recast this as an integral equation, which is already telling you that there's something fundamentally different about infinite order of PDEs as compared to the kinds of second order equations that you're used to in most applications. So for generic values of P, this contains the full infinite series of pi derivative corrections, but in the special limit, we take p goes to 1, the box squared, box cubed, and higher corrections all go to 0. And this collapses down to become a local field theory with a single power of box. And so p equals 1, you should be thinking about as the limit of local field theory for the p-adic string. And on the other hand, p large compared to 1 is the limit where the non-local structure is playing a very important role in the dynamics. And indeed, that's exactly the limit that I'm going to be interested in when I talk about cosmology. So there have been a variety of potential applications for theories along these lines, suggested some of them by people in here right now. These kinds of non-local field theories often have improved UV behavior, so you can get finite field theories. You can solve the hierarchy problem in this way. There's a variety of novel cosmological constructions. You can get self-inflation. You can get bouncing cosmologies. You can get quintessence with W less than minus 1. You can have some interesting implications for degravitating the cosmological constant problem. And then there's the application that I'm going to focus on today, which is inflation. So the question is, can you embed inflation into these kinds of non-local field theory constructions, and what sort of novel features arise when you do this? And the motivation for doing this, at least in part, is that on the one hand, this high derivative structure seems fairly generic in string theory. And on the other hand, it's becoming clear that sort of standard flat potential slow roll inflation is quite difficult to obtain in realistic string theory scenarios. And I would say it's surprisingly difficult to obtain in realistic string theory scenarios. And so you might wonder whether maybe there's a way to realize inflation that doesn't require flat potentials. And indeed, that's what I'm going to argue. I'll argue that this non-local structure is giving you a way to realize inflation, even when naively the potential is far too steep. And the nice thing about this scenario is that it's predictive, and you fairly generically get FNL large compared to 1, at least when the non-local structure is important. So before the focus here, the motivation is to talk about inflation. But before I get to that, I want to address some of the difficulties which typically arise when you work with high derivative theories. And for the most part, these are fairly well known. You often have classical instabilities.
In the quantum theory, you often have ghost-like excitations that threaten to violate unitarity. In the case where there's infinitely many derivatives, you might wonder about whether there's a well-posed Cauchy problem at all. And I think it should be clear that any application to physics, not just inflation that I'm going to talk about, but essentially any application of this kind of theory to physics, you need to worry about fundamental issues about when these things can be made ghost-free and when you can make rigorous sense of the initial value problem in this context. So before I talk about cosmology, I'm going to make a little detour to try and address these issues. So this is part two. I'll talk about ghosts and such. So it's fairly well known, but I'm going to quickly review why adding finitely many high derivative corrections almost always gets you in trouble. I'm going to illustrate this in the example of the Lee-Wick model. And the Lee-Wick theory is basically just a normal Klein-Gordon theory, and they added in an extra box squared correction. And I will assume, as did Lee and Wick, that the mass scale that suppresses this high dimension operator is large compared to the mass of the scalar field. So the equation of motion that you get looks like that. It's fourth order in time derivatives, and so of course this requires four initial data as opposed to the two that you would usually have. You have an extra box squared correction in the equation of motion, which means that now the denominator of the propagator has an extra P4 term, which means the propagator now has two poles instead of the one that you would usually have, which is telling you about the fact that this theory actually has two physical states in it. There's only one scalar field, but there's two distinct physical excitations. You can see that a bit more clearly by doing a partial fractions decomposition on this propagator, and you see you get one term that propagates the lighter fields, and then you get another term that propagates the heavier field. And the crucial thing is that there's a relative minus sign between the two terms, which is telling you that the heavier, this is just the way I've set up the sign convention, but with this convention, the heavier state is being propagated with wrong sign kinetic term in the Lagrangian, which means the heavier state here is a ghost-like excitation.
Change the sign.
Then you just make the other field a ghost. Okay. It's for whatever sign, for whatever signs you put here and here, you always have the same state.
But so even if it's the same sign,
yeah,
the terms are the same sign.
Yeah. This is a very general, so I'll show you how general the statement is in a few minutes. So you can see this even more explicitly by introducing these auxiliary fields, chi1 and chi2. I get chi1 by acting on phi with an operator that projects out the ghost state. I get chi2 by acting with an operator that projects out the non-ghost state. And if you plow through the algebra, then it turns out the Lagrangian decomposes into a regular-looking piece for chi1, a regular-looking piece for chi2, but the overall sign is wrong, and then interactions between the two. So clearly chi2 has wrong sign kinetic term, and you might wonder, who cares? And the issue is that because chi2 has wrong sign, wrong overall sign in front of the Lagrangian, it also has wrong overall sign in the Hamiltonian. So this carries negative energy density. The Hamiltonian is unbounded from below, and the system, the theory is unstable. The dynamics generically drive you towards a state which becomes arbitrarily excited the longer you wait. So there's clearly a problem, and I want to be clear about what kind of problem this is. This is, at the heart of it, this is really a classical pathology. This theory is already sick even before you quantize it. So in fact, if you choose the I epsilon prescription in the right way, the quantum field theory associated with this is actually unitary. So you make a choice between violating unitarity or having classical instability. I'm going to assume throughout that you've made the choice that you have classical instability. So this is at the guts of it a classical problem, and if you want to solve it, you should look towards a classical solution, I think. And the other thing I want to be clear about is that taking bigger values of the ghost mass doesn't help you. It actually makes the problem worse. Taking a heavier positive energy excitation would cause it to decouple from the theory. But taking a heavier negative energy excitation makes it couple more and more strongly to the theory because there's more phase space to decay into negative energy excitations. So really, the only way to salvage this kind of theory is by imposing some auxiliary constraints on the dynamics. And that's exactly what Kutkowski et al. Did back in 69. And they have sort of a complicated formalism, but at the heart of it, it's really what they did is basically equivalent to putting future-like boundary conditions on this ghost-like excitation that prevent its exponential growth in the future. So I illustrated this problem in the context of Lee-Wick, but this is actually a very general problem. So if you give me an action that depends on phi, box phi, going up to box n of phi, quite generically, n is telling you about the number of poles in the propagator because the inverse propagator is an nth order polynomial in p squared.
the number of poles in the propagator tells you how many physical excitations are in the theory. You get two initial data for physical excitation because those are the two free coefficients that you promote to annihilation creation operators when you do quantization. And of course, the number of initial data is the same as the dimension of the phase space. And back in, I think, like the 1800s, Mr. Ostrogradsky proved the theorem that when you have a Lagrangian like this, the Hamiltonian is always unbounded from below, except in the trivial local case, n equals 1. And in this picture, taking larger values of n just sort of makes things worse. And so you might wonder, what's the point of looking at n equals infinity? But bear with me for a few minutes. So the kinds of theories that I'm actually interested in are not ones where f of box is some finite order polynomial. I'm actually interested in the case where f of z is like the full transcendental function. So I'm assuming you can resum the full infinite series of high dimension operators. And the new novel thing that happens here is that the equation of motion that you get is infinite order. And these are, in some sense, fundamentally different from the kinds of second order or finite order partial differential equations that you're used to. And so it's not completely trivial to answer the question, how are you supposed to count initial data in this picture? So normally you would say, well, if I have n derivatives, I have n initial data. So infinitely many derivatives must mean infinitely many initial data. But it's not clear that that's completely true, because in the cases where these are related to integral equations, you know that integral equations don't generically admit infinitely many free coefficients. And so something more interesting must be going on. And so what you need in order to really answer this question, so I think the crucial thing that you want to answer is how many initial data are embedded by this equation. Because once you have the initial data, then you're learning about the dimension of the phase space and the number of physical states, and you're learning indirectly about the stability of the theory. So this is the question we looked at. Nikki and I, we gave a formal treatment of the initial value problem in these kinds of infinite order partial differential equations. And we give a systematic prescription for how to count how many initial data you have for an equation like this. And we gave a careful study of how to define these sort of pseudo differential operators that you have floating around. I'm not going to go through the details of the math. Instead, I'm just going to sort of heuristically argue about why it can be that infinite order differential equations can still only admit finitely many initial data. And so to illustrate this, let's look at this particular theory where I've supposed that the kinetic function factorizes into a term box minus m squared, like in a local theory, and then a term, all the non-local stuff is encoded in this gamma of box, and I'm going to assume that gamma has no zeros. So the equation of motion looks like this. It's really honestly infinite order in differential in time derivatives. But if you look at the propagator only has one pole coming from this m squared. And that's essentially by fiat because I've supposed that this gamma has no zeros. So the propagator only has one pole, which means there's only one physical excitation in this theory, which means there's only two initial data because those are the two free coefficients that turn into annihilation creation operators. And so the sort of naive n goes to infinity limit of this Ostrogradsky construction is misleading here. Now that's the heuristic like hand waving argument. Of course, what Nikki and I did was a little bit more careful than that, and we were able to prove a theorem that this kind of pole counting completely exhausts all of the allowed initial data for an equation like this. And so what this is telling you is that single pole infinite order theories can be made ghost free and can be unitary and can have well posed initial value problem with only two data. And the thing that's much less trivial is that even certain kinds of multipole theories are perfectly okay. And we didn't dwell on that in the paper with Nikki, but we're going to talk a lot more about it in the work that's coming up. And so one of the neat things that we came across when we were playing with this sort of formalism of pseudo-differential operators is that if you do have a theory that has multiple poles and has ghost-like excitations, then it turns out that there's a nice way of redefining this pseudo-differential operator in such a way as to sort of project out those ghost-like excitations and render an otherwise pathological theory ghost-free in those. So this is sort of the formalism for letting you perform some kind of exorcism. And so you remember I mentioned the only way to salvage these theories that had ghosts was by imposing some kind of auxiliary constraint. That's exactly what this is, but the nice thing is that instead of this being a constraint that you imply like on the solutions of the equation of motion order by order, this is instead a constraint that you can imply at the level of the Lagrangian while you're defining the theory. So having argued then that you can have ghost-free, stable, infinite order theories, which have well-posed initial value problem with only finitely many Cauchy data. I'm now going to talk about how we embedded inflation into this sort of construction.
Yeah. You have the function gamma?
Yeah.
I think there's a theorem that says that you have an analytic function that has a zero somewhere. So I think in your case, there's a zero at infinity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean at finite.
Sorry?
In the finite complex thin plane. It doesn't matter what happens at the point of infinity.
So you're saying that
infinity... E to the minus z is analytic and has no zeros.
But it does it at infinity because the Riemann sphere.
Yeah, I know. The point at infinity doesn't matter.
I guess naively it would seem like if you're integrating over momenta, you have a very large measure on momenta at infinity.
Yeah, the point is that when you're doing this, when you're defining the pseudo differential operator, you define it as a contour integral, and you have to put the contour at some finite point in the complex plane, and so you're always excluding the point at infinity.
You're not approaching. You're always saying somehow you're taking large finite values but never reaching infinity.
Yeah, it's just the contour has to be big enough to enclose all poles of the integrand, but that you're generally not making it enclose the point at infinity. We can talk about this more in detail later. There's no problem with it. So I'm going to look for inflation in this sort of prototype non-local field theory that I've been focusing on. And I'm going to suppose then that the potential has an unstable maximum somewhere and look for inflation where the inflaton starts at the unstable maximum of the potential and rolls away from it. And so in the string theory examples I mentioned earlier, this corresponds to looking for inflation during the decay of some sort of unstable deep ring configuration. So before I show you how to sort of get the right answer when you look for inflation in this kind of theory, I want to just quickly show you how to get the wrong answer. So naively, you might think, well, during inflation, the field is almost constant, so its derivatives are small, and then the higher derivatives are even smaller still. And so naively, you might think, well, it must be a good approximation during inflation to throw out these higher order derivative corrections and approximate this by a local field theory. And if you did this, then naively you would conclude that inflation is only possible when this mu squared mass scale, which appears in the potential, is small compared to the Hubble scale, because that's the thing that keeps the eta parameter small. And of course that works. That's one way to get inflation in this theory. But it turns out it's not the only way to get inflation in this theory. And we have examples where you get perfectly successful slow roll inflation, even when the naive eta parameter that you would infer in this way is huge. We have examples where this works even when naively eta is like 10 to the 16 or something. And just in passing, this sort of naive approach is really the approach that most models of string cosmology take. And so I'm not saying that those models are wrong. Of course, we don't invalidate that. But the thing I think is interesting about this is that maybe this is telling you that inflation from string theory is a little bit easier to get than we might have naively thought. So now I'm going to show you how to get sort of the more correct picture. So I'm interested in dynamics close to the unstable maximum, close to phi equals zero, so I can throw out the cubic and higher order interactions. And I should say we don't rely on this. This is just the easiest way to show how we got the answer. We have an independent formalism to check this, which is non-perturbative in phi. So this is the kind of action that I'm going to focus on. The equation of motion looks like this. And here mu squared is sort of the naive mass scale that you would infer from the potential. And you notice you can construct solutions here by taking phi to be an eigenfunction of box. And that works as long as the eigenvalue omega squared satisfies this transcendental equation. So what this is telling you is the dynamics of the inflaton are being set by this derived defective mass scale omega, as opposed to by the sort of naive mass scale mu squared, which is what's appearing in the potential. And of course, the cute thing is to look for scenarios where the effective mass can be small, even when naively the mass is too big to allow for slow roll. And so this is giving you some sort of mechanism for stretching out the inflaton potential and relaxing the eta problem in hilltop inflation models. So there are sort of two equivalent pictures to look at the dynamics at this level, but I'll show you this gets a little more complicated later on. So you can think about this as being sort of field theory with infinitely many derivatives and very steep potential. And the inflaton feels a strong force dragging it down the hill, but then this infinite series of high derivative corrections conspires in such a way as to slow down its motion. And this, as long as you stay very close to an unstable maximum, is dual to a local field theory where the height of the false vacuum is the same, but now the mass scale and the potential has been stretched out by the effect of the potential energy. So we gave an explicit example of this in the case of p-adic string theory.
where the Lagrangian looks like this, and the first few terms in the potential look like that. And here, this mass scale, you can see, goes like this prime number p, and I'll argue in a second that p is going to be large compared to 1. And so this mass, the naive mass scale, is typically fairly large, and you don't naively expect slow roll dynamics in this theory. But it turns out the effective mass is just being set by the string scale, is insensitive to p, and you can get 60-fold insulation in this theory, even when naively the eta parameter is huge. It turns out when you go through the details, the Kolbe normalization is relating g string and p in such a way that when you're sort of in the what I'll call natural region of the parameter space where g string is order 1, then you have p order sort of 10 to the 14, 10 to the 13. So indeed, we're going to work in the regime where p is huge compared to 1. As I promised, this is the strongly non-local regime of the parameter space. When you go through the perturbation theory predictions, you find the spectral index is always less than 1, which is a good thing. Yeah?
So have you studied perturbations around the solution to get, I mean, to see if they're all ghost-free? Because I know we had that discussion yesterday, but my bet is that, because your argument of ghost-free are all perturbative around
no, so if I,
My experience is that if you study perturbations around any non-trivial solution, you find ghost-like perturbations.
Yeah, so I was sweeping this under the rug, and in the full construction, this actually does have ghost-like excitations. But we're implicitly already using this prescription to project them out. But I should mention that the way we're using to look for ghosts is, I mean, you think of this Woodard picture where he sees that they're projected out in perturbation theory, but it's because he's moved them into the interactions in a certain way that you don't see them. So if we redo the Woodard analysis using our formalism, we agree with him. We see ghosts where he sees ghosts, but we don't see ghosts where he doesn't see ghosts. So Woodard has since then written a number of theories, written a handful of papers with sort of perfectly okay theories, and you can see that they're encompassed in the analysis. So I think it's a little bit, I think it's stronger than that. So, the spectral index is less than 1. The scalar tensor ratio is very small, which is typical in hilltop inflationary models. The string scale is well below the Planck scale, which is a good thing. And of course, the most interesting prediction for this theory is for large non-Gaussianity. So,
is there tuning? I mean, you have this parameter p in the potential as well.
Yeah, there's a tuning. There's regions. I mean,
and what happens if you take just a regular mass? A coefficient of the phi square term, which is unrelated to p.
We present the analysis in a very, well, in the first paper we just did p-adic string, but we've since presented the analysis in a general scenario. So you give me your favorite non-local field theory, I can check what the constraints on the parameters are to get inflation. I mean, there are different regimes where inflation works, but it requires fine tuning. I'm not claiming this is less fine tuning.
So it requires a fine tuning on the mass.
It requires fine tuning of the effective mass. It's just giving you a different effective mass for the dynamics than the one you would have naively expected.
No, but it's a mu. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but it looks like you've chosen the p that comes in the modified kinetic piece.
Yeah.
And then given that, you've chosen a potential which has a coefficient of the mass term, which has the same p in it.
Yeah, that's just in this. That's how it turns out to be in the p-adic string theory. I can have a very general. I can have whatever kinetic term, whatever potential term. We can write down factor slow roll parameters and see what inflation is. So, in order to see the effect of the non-Gaussianity, then I'm going to start to include. To illustrate this before, I was just focusing on the free theory, and now to see the non-Gaussianity, we're going to start to include interactions into this theory. And the interesting thing that happens is that when you start to turn on interactions, then this sort of duality between the local and the non-local theories is going to break down, and much more interesting things will happen. So before I show you how we calculated FNL in this theory, I just want to give like the hand-waving argument about why you should expect that it can be made large in a theory like this. So if I just ignore gravitational perturbations and I look at the free theory, then you have exactly Gaussian perturbations and the bispectrum is vanishing. And now as I start to turn on this interaction term, then the bispectrum is just going to be proportional to G. And so obviously, if I make G really large, then I can make FNL really large, which is a completely trivial statement. All I'm saying is that when you have a really strongly interacting theory, you have big non-Gaussianity. And that would be true in a normal model, too. But the thing is, in a conventional model, if you make this cubic interaction large, then you make the potential steep, and you destroy the slow roll dynamics of the background. And the nice thing that happens here is that we're not relying on the flatness of the potential in order to get inflation. We're relying on the funny kinetic structure. And so we can make the potential steep. Indeed, the examples that I had before, the potential was very steep. And so the interactions are very large, and you can get large non-Gaussianity in sort of this trivial way. And the novelty here is not that FNL is big. The novelty is that doing that doesn't screw up the slow roll dynamics of the background. And so in the example, the p-adic case, this cubic coupling G turns out to go like p squared, which can easily be like 10 to the 26 or something. So I'm going to focus on a theory that looks like this. I'm going to suppose that the kinetic function can be put into this form. This gamma of box has no zeros, and so you're allowed to put it into field redefinitions. And you can do a non-local field redefinition like this, which puts the free field theory into a canonical form and moves all the non-local structure into the interactions of the theory. So when I set G equal to zero, I just have a normal free local field theory where I know how to do the perturbation theory calculation. And so this should be the appropriate starting point for matching onto the standard calculation. So I'm going to follow the formalism that David Seary and friends came up with for computing bispectra from the field equations. So I'm going to focus on the inflaton equation, which looks like this. As I said, the Gaussian perturbations, this term is the non-local term now is quadratic, so the Gaussian perturbations don't feel the non-locality at all. And this delta 1 phi is just a light field and de Sitter. You have the usual sort of Hankel function solutions. And all the interesting things now in this picture are happening at second order in perturbation theory. We have the usual sort of kinetic structure for the second order inflaton perturbation. You have all the usual source terms that you would have in the local calculation. And then the only new thing is that you have this one new source term coming from the non-local interactions in the theory, which involves the first order perturbations, which I know what they are, and then I just have to act on them with these pseudo-differential operators. And when you go through the algebra of doing that, you find that the non-local structure mimics the effect of having a huge cubic coupling in the potential. And it leads to large non-Gaussianity in exactly the same way that having had a large cubic coupling would have. But again, the novelty is that doing this, having this large effective cubic coupling, isn't screwing up the slow roll of the background. So we follow through the calculation using Seary et al.'s results. This is what the nonlinearity parameter looks like. The leading term is this sort of local FNL, and then you have some momentum dependent corrections. And if you focus on the case of p-adic inflation and you look on equilateral triangles in the large p limit where the non-local structure is important, then you find FNL goes like root p up to log corrections. P can be made sort of order 10 to the 13, and so clearly this FNL can be made observably large. And on the other hand, if you look at the p-adic inflation case in the other limit where p goes to 1 where you're recovering a local field theory, you find that this collapses down to the order of slow roll parameters, which is the thing that you expect. So this is FNL on equilateral triangles as a function of G-string for different values. There's also this dependence on the number of E-foldings between horizon crossing and the end of inflation. So letting that run across sort of natural values and letting G-string run from 0 to a half, you get a plot that looks like this. This line is the Yudevin-Bondalt central value for the detection, this plus or minus 1 sigma. And so you can see for G-string, fairly natural sort of order 1 part in 10, we reproduce their detection. And you can make of that what you will, and I guess we'll hear a lot more about that.
Is it the equilateral? What did you
say? They have local ansatz also. I mean, the leading part is local, but there's momentum-dependent corrections.
What yours wasn't just is that NS minus 1?
No, what I'm saying is that this is when you go to the limit of local field theory, there's all the other terms that you would usually have here that I'm not writing out. So when you go to the limit of local field theory,
FML equals to NS minus 1 holds or doesn't?
I'm saying it holds in the limit where the non-local structure of the theory collapses. In the limit where the non-local structure of the theory is important, then FNL is big.
So this is non-local theory, not local.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I had meant to not use the word local when I said this, because sort of paradoxically, the non-local theory is giving local FNL.
We were more careful in the paper not to use the word local.
How do you get large local FNL if you have a single scalar field? Because, for example, there's this paper of criminally effective field theory of inflation, and since you have a single scalar, albeit non-local, I think you would.
Well, they don't have these terms in the paper, though. We have a strongly interacting, we have a huge trilinear.
Well, I think their formalism is just based on symmetry arguments that
well, it's not with the high derivative stuff.
It includes DBI, for example, which...
But DBI, neither DBI nor the stuff that Shingon and collaborators did includes this.
It also assumes a local effective field. Yeah, it's a likely...
Oh, it's all involved.
Infinite number of powers of first derivative, I think that's like what's...
Right, where it's here.
That's what you get in DBI, but in this case you have...
So, to compare to DBI, I just want to quickly sort of contrast this to DBI, because there's a lot of things that are qualitatively similar, but I think it's fundamentally different. So that what we have is high powers of the D'Alembertian as opposed to high powers of the first derivative in the field
in the action. So it means that the equations of motion that we get are honestly high-order differential equations, the infinite-order equations, as opposed to second-order equations, but just with really funny nonlinear structure. So it's a distinctive dynamics. The sound speed for the perturbations is 1, as opposed to being small compared to 1, like in the DBI case. In the string theory perspective, inflation here is coming from D-brain decay as opposed to from motion of some sort of mobile brain down a warped throat. The dynamics of the inflaton is slow roll in the usual sense. It's just that it's slow roll with a steep potential as opposed to the fast roll picture. And even observationally, because RFNL is closer to the local form, we can also distinguish between our model and theirs, assuming the bispectrum is large. So in conclusion, then the study of this sort of high derivative constructions is well motivated from fundamental theory. You can systematically construct stable ghost-free infinite order theories with well-posed Cauchy problem. We can embed inflation into those sorts of theories, and inflation proceeds even when naively the potential is somewhat too steep. And this is perhaps interesting because this sort of high derivative structure seems ubiquitous in string field theory at least, and so maybe this is suggesting that inflation is a little bit easier to obtain than you might have thought otherwise. This generically predicts FNL in the large FNL in the sense that FNL is large whenever the non-local structure is important in the calculation. And I think the interesting possibility would be to see if you can realize the same kind of mechanism, but in a more realistic string theory construction where, you know, of course, this p-adic string is not construed as a realistic model by itself. And even in a string field theory construction, you want to worry about the compactification, the moduli stabilization, and all this kind of thing, which we haven't talked about. So I think that's something to sort of work on in the future. And one of the sort of neat thing about this is that the effect of getting large FNL and also the consistency of the initial value problem are both relying on the UV completion sort of in a fundamental way. And so this is one example, as DVI is as well, where you're using the CMB as a probe of something that's sort of distinctly high energy. Thank you.
Slide where you showed the Lagrangian after field redefinition, where you put the kinetic term in local.
Yes.
Okay. So now, at this level, you have a large interaction term.
It's mimicking the effect of a large interaction term. So in this, when I was talking about this sort of duality, the duality is just a field definition.
See, normally you argue that in order to preserve the inflation, you can't have large interaction coupling constants because they would generate large mass terms as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm worried about the naturalness of this laboratory, technical naturalness.
That's the thing that you need to worry about model by model. At least in the case of the p-adic string, Debashish Goshal tells me that I can reliably take that action for as long as g-string is less than 1, I can run into whatever value of p I want. It's just a model input parameter. And so that sense, I don't see why P15 is more natural than P2.
No, technically natural means that, in the sense of quantum correction, it's been under control.
Yeah, that's, well,
it looks like this is not.
I mean, well, it's a question of whether you know exactly how to compute quantum correction theory. I should mention many of these theories are finite. But I think it's an issue that you need to address more.
Last question?
It looks to me that it's like having a different measure on the k-space. So I can start from a proper theory where the Lagrangian contains k-square terms. And then I change the measure in k-space. I take another k and I have an arbitrary function of k instead of k-square. Is it correct, this intuition, or there is it?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So, do you think that those theories that behave properly, that needs just one well-posed boundary condition, are dual to some local theory?
At the free field theory level, they are. At the interacting level, new things start happening.
And the speaker?